This is Karen from beautiful New Hampshire, and I'm totally stoked that there's a new Professor Buzzkill episode.
Hello, Buzzkillers. Yes, it's me. It's the Professor. It's your favorite history podcast. And fortunately for you, we have on the line via the internets Dr. Blake Scott Ball, whose new book, Charlie Brown's America, The Popular Politics of Peanuts, is making him the most trending historian in the United States these days. Hello, Professor. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Professor.
Well, it's great that you're here, and we want to tell Buzzkillers that, you know, one of the reasons we're doing this show, one of the reasons we're interviewing you is because history is about so much more than politics and battles and in court intrigue and what's going on backstairs at the White House. Cultural history is very, very important, and even things that someone might not think of, like comic strips and popular culture and popular art, are something that need to be studied both in their own context, but also in their general social and political context. And you've written a really pioneering book on this. It's absolutely fantastic how you're able to show how much not only Charles Schulz, the author and the artist of Charlie Brown, but the comic strip itself had to deal with the 20th century.
Well, thank you for those kind words. I do think that it's tremendously important for us as historians to look at not just sort of the official record, as it were, of the 20th century from the viewpoint of kind of government officials and administrations and military records and things like that, all very important, obviously, but also that we look at it from other viewpoints, other vantage points, because most Americans in the 20th century didn't live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, right.
So I think that we actually find some really meaningful, revealing, honest things about American life, concerns, visions for the future, and fears about the future in these cultural spaces where they kind of felt they could let their guard down a bit, right? In the way that they thought about these things, because they perhaps didn't realize they were being watched by history in these moments.
Right.
They were just, you know, just kind of living their normal everyday life and expressing the way they felt that particular week. And so I think we can get a really candid information about American life in the 20th century through looking at things like comic strips and the way that audiences responded to those popular mediums.
Well, you say that not every American lived at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which for our foreign buzzkillers is, of course, the White House. But one thing darn near every American did was read Peanuts, as you say in your book. It's somebody, you know, half the population read Peanuts. It's by far the most popular comic strip of the 20th century and was an institution.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to imagine in 2021 that you could get 100 million Americans focused on the same thing in the same day. Yeah, it's just we're such a diversified and sort of niche driven cultural space now. Everybody has their own kind of little place, and if you decide that you don't want to hear from, you know, certain segments or whatever, you can just completely isolate yourself. By 1970, 100 million Americans were reading Peanuts every day, and wow. from a historian's viewpoint, I felt like, man, if in the midst of all of the turmoil and change and controversies of the late 20th century, if there was something that could draw the attention of, you know, half of America every day, there's probably something there worth paying historical attention to. What was going on? What did they find of value in this space?
Yeah, and that's why the book is so important, and it really is pioneering in that way. May we start with Charles Schulz himself, Professor? First of all, who is he? He seems to be, like, to most of us, we don't really know him outside Peanuts. He seems like the most modest man in the world, apart from Mr. Rogers.
Right. Right. Well, you know, in a lot of ways, he really does kind of have that persona. I grew up in the 90s and Charles Schulz was still around, but he was very much a grandpa kind of figure by that point. Yeah. And so I'd see him from time to time in interviews. He seemed very unassuming, very humble. He is born in the 1920s in St. Paul, Minnesota. He grows up there. He is an only child, the son of a local barber in St. Paul. Mm-hmm. And he describes himself as not a particularly impressive student during his school years. Oftentimes, I think because he was more interested in art than he was in his schoolwork. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He liked to draw a lot of the popular cartoons and things of the time, like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and Popeye and all those sorts of characters. And when he graduates high school, his mother finds an ad for a correspondence art program where you could do the lessons from home and send them in and they could be graded and remarked upon. And then you could develop that way. And so he takes on this program. It doesn't go to college, but he does this art correspondence course, does it for a couple of years. And it turns out that he's good enough at it that he actually ends up getting hired by the school, which was headquartered in Minneapolis. Huh. And so he starts working for the school. Well, this is by this point, 1941, going into 1942. Of course, Pearl Harbor is about to intervene in all of Americans' plans for the 1940s. And he, in 1942, gets drafted into the U.S. Army. Mm-hmm. So he goes off to war for 3 years. Shortly after he's drafted, his mother, who had been kind of quietly, they actually hadn't shared the information with Charles Schulz, but she had been suffering from cervical cancer and she passes away not long after he's drafted.
Right.
So he goes off to Europe. He describes this as the most lonely period in his life. He just, you know, the only person he felt like he had in the world was his dad, and his dad was on the other side of the ocean, and he just really struggles in his experience in the military, but also discovers some things about himself. He continues doing art. He works his way up to squad leader in light machine gunning. And when he makes it back to the U.S., he has decided he wants to pursue full-time art. He wants to be a comic strip artist. Mm-hmm. He starts developing ideas. Initially, he wants to do, they were real popular right around the world, wartime. He wants to do kind of wartime military comic strips. Uh-huh. He's thinking maybe something like military kind of comedy, maybe like Willie and Joe, like Bill Malden had done. He was a big fan of that. And we get some examples of that in some of his sketchbooks of different kind of humorous military panels that he would do. He kept a sketchbook that he titled As We Were and does some cartooning in there. But a number of his friends in cartooning say, hey, the war's over. People are tired of war. You got to find something else. And he drew some pretty funny kids, mm-hmm. that with these kind of big bubble heads and small bodies. And a lot of his counterparts thought that was funny. And they're like, do the children cartoons. It's really fitting for the time when you think about it, because going into the 1940s and especially into the 1950s, America is going to experience, in the Western world, honestly, is going to experience a baby boom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the audience that would have been reading the daily newspaper and is dealing with a whole bunch of these little people running around in their homes and in the middle of their lives and trying to figure all that out. And so it is a space ripe for discussion in the funny pages. And so he takes that on and he sends out comic strips and panels all over the place. He finally gets picked up by the Saturday Evening Post on some kind of one-off pieces with right. these children characters. And at that point, he sort of uses this to help catapult him into the conversation with a couple of different syndicates. He has a conversation in 49 with a syndicate in Chicago that ultimately doesn't pan out. And then United Features Syndicate in New York City ends up being the one to finally sign him to a deal in 1950.
We should point out to the Buzzkillers, or remind them anyway, those of a certain age will know, but most of us won't, is that the You know, the Saturday Evening Post was the big popular magazine for years and years and years, probably into the early 60s. I don't remember when it stopped, but it was absolutely the sort of, well, it was before Reader's Digest, well, maybe it was before Reader's Digest, but it was the most read publication in the country. So when does his first Peanuts cartoon appear?
The very first one runs October 2nd, 1950.
Uh-huh.
And it ran in seven national newspapers, including Denver Post, Seattle Times, Washington Post. And it's a really kind of odd, quirky beginning. Mm-hmm. The opening scene has a little boy and a little girl. We don't know their names. We find out later on in the week. They're sitting on the front step out in front of their house, and they look down the street. And the boy says, "Here comes good old Charlie Brown." And here comes this kid with a blank shirt. He doesn't have his check marks, you know, the kind of zigzag line shirt yet. Here he comes walking down the street. He's got a big smile on his face. And the boy says to the girl, "Oh, good old Charlie Brown." And then Charlie Brown walks out of the panel. And in the final panel, the boy says, "Good old Charlie Brown, how I hate him." Yeah, I point out that actually a woman in Minneapolis, where Schultz was living at the time, writes into the newspaper there and says, you know, there's enough hatred in the world in 1950 without having these kids hating each other on the comic strip. So, you know, some people were wondering, why in the world would you start off hating your lead character?
But it very accurately captured the sort of, you know, kids talk and the way they interact with each other. But as you say, and as you've been kind of implying all along, this is all happening, you know, at the end of World War II, getting into the 1950s. And, you know, his comic strip buddies tell him to get away from the military humor, get into the, you know, that the kid humor seems to be really great, stick with that. But all the while, there's this big thing looming over the country and over the Western world, and that is the Cold War. And your second chapter talks about Charlie Brown coming to be in the period of the Cold War. In fact, you call it the Cold War Origins of Peanuts.
One of the things I wanted to do when I first started in on this project, I had some collections of the Peanut strips that were published by Fantagraphic Books, a company out in Seattle. They republish a lot of old comic strips and comic art and things. So they had published, or they had started at the time, publishing every one of the Peanut strips in order. And so I could see, you know, October 2nd, October 3rd and 4th, and, you know, just day after day.
Oh, wow.
But one thing I wanted to do was to say, okay, well, if I were a reader in one of these newspapers in October 1950, how am I getting this, right? I'm not getting Peanuts isolated from the rest of the newspaper. I'm getting it in a context.
Sure, sure.
And so I dug up the microfilm on these newspapers, and it was really striking to look at, for example, the Denver Post. During the first week that Peanuts ran, decided to put Peanuts, to help promote it, they put Peanuts on the front page of the newspaper.
Oh, wow.
So for the first 5 days, it's right there on the front page. It's the only comic strip on the front page. Everything else is in the comic section. So it's right there beneath these big, bold headlines about the North Koreans invading the DMZ in Korea. It's about suspected communist plots in Berlin. And all these different kinds of Cold War rich moments that are going on right here along with, you know, this smiling little bubble-headed kid, Charlie Brown, walking down the street. And you couldn't miss that these two things are juxtaposed together. And one of the things that stuck out to me, especially in the 1950s, which is a really, if there are any Peanuts fans out there among your listeners, the 1950s strips are really, especially, I would say up to about 58 or so, are really different from what we would recognize as classic Peanuts. The character art looks different, and it's still developing. Some of the characters like Linus and Lucy were actually much younger during the 1950s than we would come to recognize them later in the 60s and beyond. In this period, Schultz has, in some cases, a darker approach to the characters. To put it in the terms of the time, oftentimes he was referred to as one of America's great young existentialists.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
That he was kind of able to strike this balance between the humor of daily life, but also the bleakness of, and maybe even potential hopelessness of the world's future in this nuclear, atomic and nuclear age. So all sorts of really interesting themes are going to pop up in the 1950s in Peanuts. For example, Charlie Brown and Lucy playing hydrogen bomb tests.
Wow.
At one point, yeah. There is another episode where Linus, who has been, he's one of the youngest of the characters in the 1950s. So we are introduced to him as an infant and then have watched over a couple of years him kind of grow in 58, I believe. It's really his first winter where he is big enough to talk and to go outside mm-hmm. and to start going to school with the preschool with the other kids. And he walked outside one day and it starts snowing and he panics. He panics. He turns around and he starts running back home and he runs into Charlie Brown on the way. And Charlie Brown, what's the matter? What's happening? It's just a little snow. And Linus kind of sigh of relief says, oh my goodness, I was afraid it was that fallout that everyone keeps talking about.
Yikes.
Yeah. That, you know, to just this comment upon, you know, this child that has been so inundated by the conversation of the nuclear world that he mistakes snow for the nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah. That's amazing because in many ways that sort of stuff kind of disappears in later chapters, right. I shouldn't say later, in later decades
yes.
of the uh-huh. of the strip. But I mean, again, like we want people to go to the blog post, to go to the Buzzkill bookshelf to get the book because it is so good. It's the best $35, trust me, Buzzkillers, you spend all year. And by the way, it must be the best Christmas, birthday, Father's Day gift ever for any baby boomers in your family.
Yeah.
But I was super attracted to the ways in which you went through the late 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and you addressed, I'm just going to list them off to the Buzzkillers, and then we can talk about them. You know, race and race integration, Vietnam, the conservation movement, gender roles, abortion rights, sex education. You know, I never really thought, I must have read Peanuts every single day forever, and I never really thought about that, those things being brought up, but they were just done in a very Charles Schulz sort of way. The first one that you bring up is race and race integration. How does that sort of make its appearances in the strip?
Yeah, I love the way that you put, you know, these issues were approached in a very Charles Schulz sort of way. He mm-hmm. first and foremost, he believed that his number one job doing good artwork, his number one job was to help a newspaper editor sell more newspapers.
That was a fascinating aspect that comes in the introduction and then later on. But it's amazing that he was so conscious of that right at the front.
Yeah, yeah. And it really affected the way that he thought about addressing issues that could be more controversial, like school integration, racial integration. So his initial approach to racial integration in the comic strip is to, like most pop culture producers of the mid-60s, was to avoid it,
mm-hmm.
to kind of create a space in a world where you didn't have any sort of racial turmoil like you were seeing in the news, in large part because there weren't different ethnicities or races in the comic strip.
Right.
And this gets to one of the big primary source groups that I used in building this book, which is fan letters.
Ah.
Letters from fans across the country over the years by the hundreds and thousands. At one point in the 60s, he says that his office is getting about 500 letters a day.
Lordy.
In the mail. And a lot of them are, you know, a lot of them are very kind of mild, that, you know, just, hey, love Charlie Brown, thank you so much, you know, that kind of stuff. But others get into what they see in the comic strip or what they would like to see, or how they see the comic strip relating to what's going on in the world. And one set of letters he gets starting in early 1968 is from a stay-at-home mother in Southern California who had always, it seems, been concerned about kind of media content for children in America. Mm-hmm. It's a time mm-hmm. where, in a lot of ways, television is not a young medium, but it's still kind of like where we are in the internet right now. Like there's still a lot that we're trying to decide, well, what should the boundaries be and should it be regulated and all these kind of things. And so TV was not that different and children's programming was developing. And she believed that the cultural representations in mass media should reflect America.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she is really leaning on Schultz saying, you know, you've got this platform that people respect you. They enjoy your cartoon. And it would really make a big difference if you were to introduce a Black character. Now, putting this in context, in 1968, of course, in April, Martin Luther King was assassinated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Later that summer, Robert Kennedy, who was running for the Democratic nomination for president and had already been a symbol in helping to fight for school integration in his brother's administration, right. but was also championing these ideas in his campaign. And he's assassinated in the summer of 68. And so it's in this context. And initially, Charles Schulz says, I just don't know that I'm the right person to write a Black character. I'm a white man from the Midwest. He says, I don't want to create something that would be patronizing to Black readers. Right. And so this lady actually goes to some friends in her community and starts collecting letters from African-American families in her community to send to Schulz. And she asks them, would you write to the cartoonist and tell him what it would mean to you and to your children to see Black representation in the most popular comic strip in America? Yeah. And so they write these letters. She sends them off. Apparently, there were more to come. She sends off the ones she has before they're all grouped together. And ultimately, it persuades Schulz to say, you know what? I may not be the perfect voice for this, but this is an important platform. And he did believe in the values of integration. And so he, in late July, early August 68, he integrates Peanuts. And it is national news, and it's widely celebrated and is not particularly controversial until this new Black character, Franklin, moves in 69 and 70, moves to town where Charlie Brown initially meets him on vacation, on right. summer vacation. Well, Franklin moves to town and starts going to school with the other white children. In fact, he gets a seat at the front of the class in front of mm-hmm. Peppermint Patty. And at that point, that scene, it was done as the most natural, just sort of normal thing in the world. It's just two Peanuts kids sitting in a classroom talking to each other. But in the context, 1969, 1970, especially in the Deep South, where like I'm here in Alabama, the governor, George Wallace, was still fighting the federal courts, trying to prevent school integrations in public schools in Alabama. Newspaper editors in the Deep South actually began writing in protest to the syndicate and to Charles Schulz saying, look, we can't run these
wow.
in our current political context. We cannot run these strips. And so they actually start any strips that would show Franklin in the classroom with white characters. They just wouldn't run Peanuts that day. They would pull it.
That's just astounding. It's astounding.
Yeah. But Schulz was insistent. He believed it was the right thing to do. And if there were those that were offended by it, this was the typically agreeable and inoffensive Schulz decided if somebody's going to be offended by this, then they're just going to have to be offended.
Right. Right. Which is quite a stance, really,
mm-hmm.
To make. Right. Well, Professor, I suppose that the other big thing, although it's again, Buzzkillers, you're just going to be amazed. The bang for your buck in this book is amazing because it's not only talking about environmentalism and all kinds of gender issues. The Vietnam War is a real big element of not only the book, but of Charles Schulz's life and also of the sort of flow of Peanuts. How does that sort of develop? The two big words that jump out at me about that chapter are ambivalence and empathy.
Mm.
Usually we don't hear that when we're talking about the Vietnam War is all conflict at home, protest, counter-protest, and on and on and on. But ambivalence and empathy really adds a lot of color to the understanding of what was going on in the 60s in the Vietnam War.
Right. You know, one of the things that when I started to graduate school and started into my coursework and things, and I was reading much more deeply about different periods that had interested me. One of the things I started doing in earnest was every time I would come home to visit my family, I was seeking out my neighbors who were older, my grandparents, mm-hmm. and asking about, you know, these things that I knew had gone on in their lifetime. What was this like? What was that like? What was this? And as they would start telling stories about their vantage point on some of these things, some of the keys that would come up in the history books were there,
yeah.
But there were always kind of other elements. I'm like, well, wow, that's I've never heard history books really talk about that. I'm not seeing that discussed. And one of these characteristics was this sort of sense of ambivalence. We get a quite polarized picture of the Vietnam War in American popular life, and that was absolutely there. Right. That's not fabricated. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely there. But what gets missed a lot of times is the kind of broad swath of people who were in some range in between that sort of, they're not always exactly sure why we're in Vietnam, but also they believe that, you know, if that's the thing that the U.S. believes we should be, that the government believes we should be doing in order to keep the world safe and things like that, okay, maybe we kind of understand. And that kind of general ambivalence does shift. The anti-war movement has a tremendous effect on popular opinion.
Yeah.
And it really does shift it to the point to where by the late 60s and early 70s, the general opinion has become, we need to get out of Vietnam as soon as it's safe for our servicemen and women.
Right.
What I see Charles Schulz developing in his conversation is really reflecting some of this ambivalence, this hatred for war, but also the acceptance that maybe this is the thing that we kind of have to do, whether we want to do it or not, but also this kind of shifting and growing disdain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then at the very heart of that, all kind of reflected through the prism of Charles Schulz's own experience as a soldier.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And as a reluctant soldier. Right. Someone who did not choose to be there. He understood very well how young men in the late 1960s might have felt getting a draft card in the mail. And so that's where I see sort of these expressions of empathy. And the really interesting vehicle for this, and I think it was unintentional at first. The two were kind of unrelated at the outset. But the vehicle for this is Snoopy's fantasy battles as the World War I flying ace riding the Red Baron.
Right, right.
Which was huge. This is a moment where Snoopy, starting with that storyline in 1965, Snoopy is going to become so big in Peanuts that Charles Schulz says it's almost at times like a fight to prevent Snoopy from taking over the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It would have been very easy to just almost abandon the kids and make it a strip all about Snoopy because his imaginings and adventures were just so big. But through this storyline, Schulz begins developing some initially subtle but increasingly pretty blatant comments on warfare. Snoopy becomes a POW at one point.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
A lot of times at the beginning, you would have Snoopy would sort of narrate what was going on. You just see him sitting atop his doghouse in his flying ace costume and he's narrating. But increasingly, these stories became very visual. So that in the panels, the neighborhood actually begins to vanish. And next thing you know, Snoopy is behind enemy lines on the war-torn French countryside.
Right, right.
And so it's becoming this very kind of visceral experience in the comic strip, to the point to where at one point Snoopy comes back and hides in the bed after a particular battle, and he's trembling. And Charlie Brown looks straight at the audience and says, "I'm really starting to worry about my dog." In this situation. So Schulz increasingly is kind of intertwining what's going on with Snoopy and what's happening in Vietnam in ways that I talk about in the chapter. And it gets to the point that by the early 1970s, Schulz stops drawing the flying ace scenarios altogether.
Wow.
And in fact, doesn't pick them up again until several years later. And he says the reason that he did that was because he said by 1970, it was clear that the war had become so ugly, such a ugly situation that it just wasn't funny.
No, it wasn't funny.
It wasn't the kind of thing to deal with in the strip anymore.
And he probably thought at the time it doesn't help editors sell newspapers, which is, again, what that point that he tried to make in the beginning of his career.
Right. And so again, and Schultz would continue this on throughout his career, even into the 90s when he started an annual D-Day remembrance for World War II. Schultz often, when he would think about war, he often emphasized in the comic strip the experience of the everyday kind of soldier.
Sure.
The things that they missed from home, the things that they were sacrificing, the fears and anxieties that they had. It was basically Schultz's message, this message of empathy was, hey, regardless of what you think about the politics of a war, don't forget about the people that are being called upon to do their job in these conflicts. And in the time of the draft, people who oftentimes were unwillingly called upon, you know, they had no desire to be there, but that's where they found themselves. He understood that, and he tried to communicate that to his audience. And again, in reader response, we see it was quite effective.
Oh, yeah.
Both from audiences here and also the actual soldiers in Vietnam who were reading these things and would write letters to Schultz and say, hey, thank you for getting it. Like, thank you for understanding, for helping us get through these times so far away from home.
Thank you for getting it. That's really something, you know, thank you for understanding. Thank you for having that empathy. It's really something, you know, very reflective and also very sophisticated way of that the soldiers were reading the strip.
Right.
Well, Buzzkillers, you know, like I've been saying throughout this show, I'm a big fan of this book. I'm a big fan of Dr. Ball's work. And one of the reasons that it's so great to study history nowadays in the 21st century. One of the reasons it's so great to read history now in the 21st century is because it's so interesting to follow historians. And like a lot of young, pioneering, pathbreaking historians, Dr. Ball has immense influence on social media. He has his own Medium, blog on medium.com, which is a blog for important writers. And I hope this show will be posted on it.
Yes.
He's a big presence on Twitter. What's that like, Professor? Is that sort of, it was so different from when I was starting that, you know, it's almost another profession. You almost have to have this second sort of PR department as part of your life and your work.
Well, when I went into graduate school and started pursuing history as a profession, it wasn't something that was really on my radar to do. At that point, social media was largely just a way to keep in touch with, you know, high school friends and things like that.
Right.
But really with the advent of Twitter in the late aughts, and I don't know exactly what it was about that medium, but that medium just really seemed to suit itself to really kind of salient conversations and really sharp, pithy insights and things like this and all the threads and everything. And one of the advisors on my dissertation mentioned to me at one point as I was working on some of these ideas, he said, you need to get on Twitter. And I kind of laughed initially. I'm like, get on, you know, for
that's
what?
Amazing.
What are you talking about?
That's what the kids
said,
do.
He said at that point, you know, he was a junior faculty. He was just a few years older than me. And he said, look, I'm talking to publishers, like they're starting to ask, like, how many social media followers do you have? You know,
what's your,
I was like, well, I guess I need to start doing this thing. It really is kind of odd in some ways to think about approaching things that way. But in a lot of ways, it has shaped the way that I approach writing this book. It kind of changed the way I thought about my audience, not just being an audience of academic historians, but being a broader audience of people from all kinds of different backgrounds and fields that are interested in history more generally, but also it's put me into touch with so many other young historians and scholars that are doing really interesting work that, as I see conversations they're having, have influenced the way that, you know, I see their reflection in one corner. I go, oh man, I wonder, what if I took that lens and put it over here in Peanuts? I wonder what I would find, right? There's just so many engaging conversations that I kind of couldn't imagine now doing my work without these outlets, because it has created just such a rich network for talking with your audience, but also talking with other scholars and circulating ideas among each other.
Yes, it really has changed the profession. And of course, what we're going to do with the blog post for this episode is we're going to put the link to your Medium page. We're going to put, obviously, your Twitter handles and all that stuff. And it just remains for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This was wonderful. I've enjoyed all the previous episodes, and I'm just very honored to get to be a part today.
Oh, well, honored is a big word. And we're just so lucky. We're so lucky in the history world, I think, that there's so many, again, young people who are working at mining at the coalface, as they say, doing great work. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Before we go, I'd like to remind everyone to go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com for all the info about the show, to read the blog posts, to catch up on past episodes, to follow us on social media, as we've been talking about, and of course, to support the Buzzkill Institute on Patreon. Please become part of the solution to history myths and misconceptions, rather than perpetuating the problem of spreading historical urban legends. History is complex, but it's also compelling. And when we study it more fully, as we've seen in this episode, we can come to a better understanding of ourselves, our societies, and perhaps even our future. Talk to you next week.